love these lullabies you give me.
They go with the material we're about to hear, that meditative stuff.
Yes, yes.
Good. We had enough meditative. I'm done with meditative.
You are?
Yes. Because we got a guest today that makes a difference. All right, let's hear. What's
the heck with introspection.
What we're going to hear about. I'm anxious to hear more of the Weasel Slayer story. Do you think that's possible?
What incredible luck.
Ah, I'd like to hear something about his rapid maturity.
During his second period of rapid maturity, celebrated in Navajo ritual by dancers in colorful corn dog and Quimby quail costumes, leaping and bounding around a giant adobe hat, Weasel Slayer grew by leaps and bounds. His height, girth, personal hygiene habits, and purpose in life all changed. He soared to an elevation of 18 hands. Can you calculate that?
5 feet 6?
No! No! He soared!
Soared! 18 times 4.
Yeah.
4 times 3, 4, 72. Oh, sorry, I didn't add that up right. That's 6 feet. 6, 7 times 12 is 72.
Yes,
yeah,
very
6
well.
Feet. Okay.
Bulked up to 10.5 stone. If we pass over that, or
A stone. Wait, stone. That would be 210 pounds.
No.
I forget what a stone is.
14 pounds.
Oh, I thought it was 20.
No, that's 14? Leagues.
20,000 leagues. Okay, yes. Under the stone.
And discovered the breath freshening powers when applied vigorously to the gum and tongue of pumice.
Oh, I thought that was pume ice.
Oh.
That cold sort of breath mints they've been selling.
Pume ice. I'm starting to lose my train.
I'm not. It was his second period of rapid maturity after leaping and bounding.
Exactly.
Stuff. Yeah.
Then he cut back on the slaying of weasels and other short-legged carnivores aspect of life on Dzil Naudli to concentrate on arts and leisure. His art largely consisted of creating large piles of plate tectonic rubble that were abstract representations of his black jetstone fetish. But Weasel Slayer especially liked the practice of leisure, for it allowed him to spend more time in consort with the likes of Corndog Woman and other proto-trollops. Florence, Miranda, and Blanche of the Near Water People come readily to mind, as they did for Weasel Slayer. But there at last came a time when he was ready for a breather from his carnal pleasures, and so he entered a period of meditation and self-contemplation, or the Wiggers.
Oh, good, because I was sure hoping you were going to say, like, leisure breather, which I couldn't possibly say more than once.
Nor could leisure I. Breather. That's why I got, didn't...
The Wiggers, the Wiggers.
Before Blanche could talk him out of it, Weasel Slayer journeyed to a desert that child born of water hadn't yet inundated. He sat amongst the dunes for 6 days and 6 nights, though again in real Earth time, it was closer to a million bucket of minutes. He had not thought to pack a lunch, and so did not eat, at least not at the nearby corn dogs and weasels stand. On the first day, he experienced a powerful vision, which somehow made the time fly. In it, he and 30 invisible beanbags were suspended in a fuliginous... Oh, no!
No, not again!
Oh, heavens, what is it? It was... Yeah.
It comes up too quickly.
It does. He and 30 invisible beanbags were suspended in a fuliginous pool of gravy. Diffused by the murky liquid, the sky above him seemed bleak and wholly unfunny. Abruptly, the sun rose... But the ears and chin that stuck out from the corona soon convinced him that the object wasn't a solar source of heat and light, but rather an immense face. Immediately he trusted it, and he flashed it an OK sign, mouthing the universal Navajo greeting, Yatahe! Multiple millennia later, when he saw the face again in real Earth time, it sat on the head of a musical shaman named
Bino
Benghazi. Weasel Slayer at once introduced himself, and the rest is historical revisionism.
End parentheses. Where did it start? Oh, there it is, multiple millennia later, I see.
On the second day, he was visited by Talking God, who, as his name suggests, chattered away like there was no tomorrow, which, due to an anomaly in the time-space continuum, there wasn't. This made the time slow way down. On the third day, Weasel Slayer discovered a catch of savory hallucinogenic mushrooms at the magnetic center of one of the sand dunes, which he ate, i.e. the fungi, not the sand. This made the time fly again, and, after a couple of false tries, him too.
Fuliginous fungi.
Fuliginous. Yum. But the mushrooms were too few and far between to be considered a satisfying meal, particularly to the hearty trencherman that Weasel Slayer aspired to be. He was still so hungry that on the fourth day he ate of the patchouli plant that hung inverted in the air above the mushroom catch, or so it appeared to his lingeringly altered sensibilities. For a while, and we can unequivocally say that this while lasted 119 hours in real Earth time, Weasel Slayer didn't know if he really ate the plant or just dreamt it. But after a different while, whose length is still debated by Navajo scholars, he developed a rash on his two favorite digestive organs. They itched like all get out and grew red and splotchy when he tried to get them all out by scratching them in a kind of a zen way. But otherwise, it was a good rash, in that his immune system developed unparalleled potency. Day number 5 was filled with more dreams. In one, the rascally Coyote was mustering an army of lemmings, big ones, in the third underworld, preparing to march on Dazil Naudili. But his plot was foiled when Spider-Woman...
Spider-Woman?
Yeah, remember her? She's been a couple of chapters.
Oh, goodness, I don't remember.
Yeah, well, when Spider-Woman chased the lead lemming into the newly created Algonquin Sea, and the rest of the army dutifully followed the leader. That's leader, not leader as in court.
Yes, I was catching that, yes.
Okay. In another, he was back at the cavern with spirit guides Bunyip Boy, Wampum Joe, and the still smoldering remnants of Shishka Bob. The four of them gesticulate broadly with feather puppets, causing enormous amounts of plumage to rain down from the sky. The third dream followed the passage of another while, the last of the second period of rapid maturity.
Oh.
What? Ah?
Yeah, I want more of those periods of rapid maturity. They're so exciting.
I can tell. Yes.
It forces me to calculate.
Oh, it does?
Yes, makes my brain work.
Oh, well,
all those hands.
Not too many of that.
Leaders and stones.
It featured another cameo by Quimby the Quail, who told First Man's first son that his newly supercharged immune system had opened the door to immortality for him. Nevertheless, it was important to avoid saturated fats and landmines, and to always look both ways when crossing the street.
Crossing the split infinitive.
Yes, we do that. Quimby went on and on with his admonitions until Weasel Slayer grew so weary of them that he awoke prematurely, trapping the quail in the semi-conscious penumbra of the dream world. But Weasel Slayer instantly comprehended the reality of his dream vision and knew that, even though he hadn't sneezed, he had been blessed. The Wiggers, according to modified Navajo myth, concludes on the sixth day, when the quietude is broken by a visit from Child Born of Water, who had been tipped off as to his whereabouts by a lascivious Blanche. Child Born of stoked the fires of falling water, and soon the rain poured down on the Mediterranean desert. Drenched, but no longer perishable, Weasel Slayer concluded his second period of rapid maturity by returning to the land of First Man and First Woman, where Miranda was directing the Living Kaya'ani Theater in a version of the story of Ye Itzo, more suitable to young audiences, of which the four Earth clans were now overstocked. In real Earth time, this coincides with a giant party thrown by Akbar the Great in Delhi, India, in November 1600, which in turn shares significant synchronicity with the party some 401 years later, an event only slightly couched in the sophistries of this 335th episode of Calvos and Damien's New Music Bazaar, whose Davenport Kosher. Davenport Kosher. Daven, is that it?
Fine enough.
Fine. Shall now be opened by Calvos.
Akbar the Great, wouldn't that be like Akbar or Great the Great? Doesn't Akbar mean great?
I didn't get that far. I stopped exploring history.
This weasel slayer guy is beginning to sound more and more like Wesley Crusher, I'm afraid.
Oh, no.
Yes.
Well, then it's time to leave him.
Yes, something to do him, to make him disappear, to go with the Wanderer or something.
Oh, heavens. All right.
Keep wanting to punch him.
He gets one more chapter, and then he sort of goes away.
I see. Let's go away for a while and listen to the rest of Ian Chuprun's Under the Playground. Under the Playground, piece by Ian Chuprun. Introducing today's show. You know, was it last week when I said we should present a show of among the most unlistenable pieces of all time?
No, that was 2 weeks ago.
2 weeks ago. Well, in any case, the opportunity has come.
Has it indeed?
Yes, our guest today at 3 o'clock is Fred Szymanski, who's live in the studio with us today, or will be, who is in residence, unlike us, at Goddard College for a while. And got in touch because a couple of weeks ago, as part of our September 11th gallery, he submitted a piece called Wedge. And he said, oh, by the way, I'll be up in your area. And so we're going to talk to him today. So we've had to do a cram course in Szymanski technique.
Szymanski, semantics.
Szymanskitics. Something like that. And so he'll be with us in about 15 minutes. And in the meantime, we're going to listen to more of the unlistenable. This time that we've heard Ian Chuprun's Under the Playground, now we're going to hear Peter Batchelor's piece, Velocity. Music that won't calm the nerves.
Maybe not you, but me.
The horrendous act.
From the compact disc set, two CDs, Présence 2, that was Peter Batchelor's Velocity. give a little bit of his notes here.
Oh, do.
The piece involves an exploration of ways in which speed, or conversely, stagnancy, might be implied entirely from the use of sound, both real and unreal, and placed within a context that allows it free rein as a musical device. Cinematic elements suggesting movement have been combined with gestures and textures of varying energy and complexity, the electroacoustic medium permitting fluid interaction between the two.
Not to mention a nice tune.
Yeah, and lots of energy and such in there. Actually, good listening, despite the fact that, by and large, these electroacoustic pieces are not exactly what you would want to hang on your wall next to the Black Velvet Kittens.
You might hang them on the wall for target practice or after they've been put into the microwave so they have that nice ripple effect on them.
The ripple effect. Well, let's listen to one more piece before we get to that. That was from the CEC recording. This is another one called Cash 2000. This is Jeff Chippewa's duo. WGDR Plainfield. Before that, Jeff Chippewa's duo, a piece for alto saxophone samples and computer.
That would make two.
Two what?
Two things.
Duo.
Ah, how very clever.
Yes, isn't that?
Yes.
How well done that was. That was from Cash 2000, a collection from the Canadian electroacoustic community.
And since we're still awaiting our guest.
Yes, Fred Szymanski is not yet here in the studio. He was sort of making his way around. Maybe he can't find the door. This is a tricky place to find your way into.
As we've discovered year in and year out.
Yes, as poor guests will be banging their fists on the other side of the padlock. You have to go around to the back, folks. Okay. Let's listen, in the meantime, to a sort of a classic work in this area of unlistenable.
I know it's coming, but
Yes, the Sanctus. From Michel Chion's Requiem. Here it is.
Hum along.
Yes, one of those very exciting relaxing tunes. That's Michel Chion's Requiem. The whole thing has to be heard one of these days. A classic work created in IRCAM some 30 years ago, and just a remarkable thing. Classic in the realm of non-background music.
Well, not as such. But speaking of background.
Yes, our guest is here. Fred Szymanski's here. Welcome.
Thank you.
Oh, let me just get your level.
Do you hear me?
There we are.
And we should point out that this is not the same family as the singer Szymanski who invented the sewing machine.
Oh, right.
Singer Szymanski and Fred are different.
Different.
Is that correct?
Yes, that is.
Or did you invent the
sewing machine?
Right.
No, I didn't.
Oh, okay. Just checking.
Welcome. This is great. You are here for at the associated institution to the WGDR,
That's
Goddard
correct.
College, for, on a residency.
Yes.
What brings you here? How did you get here, and what are you doing in this residency?
And do you get paid for this?
I actually do.
Wow.
We're stunned.
Geez.
And I have, there are other perks, JetBlue, round trip.
Oh, man.
And a cafeteria pass at the New England Conservatory of
The Culinary Institute?
No, I think it is the
Conservatory of Good
Eating.
And what else? Oh, and then I have there's an intermittent stop at Carnegie Mellon. I'm leaving next week for, I have to do a little show for Melissa
Rigona, who is just here.
Yes,
yeah.
She invited me, actually.
Fantastic.
We met in New York and hit it off, and she had a spot for me.
And then she left.
And she left.
And she's gone, and then you'll be gone.
I'm on my own, yeah. I guess I was following the footsteps of Bob Bielecki, if that's a
that's
transition.
That's not a familiar story to us.
Bob Bielecki was here last year or the year before? I think last year.
We don't know. You see, we're merely window dressing.
We're pawns in this scheme of radio power.
That's right.
Right.
Well, tell us about yourself. We met very quickly online because we had a call for scores for new pieces for our September 11th musical gallery pieces created in response to September 11th. 11th, and you sent a very exciting one along called Wedge.
Yes.
And then you said you were going to be in the area. But beyond this wonderful quote, which I'll read,
okay,
a piece we're going to actually hear today, the reviewer said that the thin Duke of white noise, Fred Szymanski. Thin white Duke, you say. What's that supposed to mean? Well, Fred is to noise music what David Bowie had been to, well, all the different kinds of music he's influenced. Now, to be fair, Fred is no Ziggy. He's not pushing the envelope so far as the way he looks, unless he secretly looks like a Smurf, and he's just pretending to look like Fred. Fred pushes a whole new kind of envelope, an envelope of terror sound and hate sound and fear sound and many other sounds that no one else wants and sounds that most people would happily throw away or never even notice.
Wow.
That was exciting.
Yes.
Yes. That's by Kieran.
Right.
I don't know who she is.
Nor I.
Yeah. She's one of those web reviewers that turns up. I think she was... She was on some large website, and she was thrown off. So she's very controversial. But you know, I took it as a compliment. Some people would not. I actually sent a review to a friend, collaborator, and mentor, Agostino DiCipio, and he was insulted by those words. Not for my sake, but that people would use metaphors and such flowerful language to describe the material of sound. And he's coming from a European tradition, very purist.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
And do you come from a European tradition? What is your
My
genesis?
Background. Yes. No, I come from North American perspective. I've been influenced by the Canadian soundscape work and the World Soundscape Project and Barry Truax and Hildegard Westerkamp and Murray Schafer. But I really studied electronic music, analog synthesis at Brown. When I was an art student at Rhode Island School of Design. So I have a visual art background, and then I realized I have a film degree. I was came out of the independent film movement.
You won an award a couple of years ago as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've actually begun to work in video again because of DV and the technology, and I'm recombining the two mediums at this point. But I studied electronic music. I realized I was working with tape loops and film loops and continuous optical printing, and I used random and stochastic and aleatoric strategies to compose these visual pieces at the time, and it was so much cheaper to work with tape recorders.
Right.
So
yes.
I came to New York and I started working with tape recorders and synthesis and studied, again, synthesis with Jan Hall at Pass when Pass was just Pass. It's Harvest Works now.
For our listeners, tell us what Pass is.
Public Access Synthesizer Studio, right. Which my mutated into Harvest Works, which is a little bit more developed institution. But at that time... I was in the 80s. I was worked in electronic music, at live electronic music, in a more of a group setting. And when people were forming groups and performing live and trying to get the kudos that way. But I've always had an interest in pure sound and material and synthesis. And in the early 90s, I started working my own and started doing what I'm doing now.
Let's hear something. What's a good starter piece for us?
Should we play Wedge?
Sure, let's do that.
Can I give you this copy?
Sure.
It's a remix.
Oh, good.
Oh, a remix. Great.
The genesis of Wedge really came out of a project I was working on with for a remix project for Asphodel that's upcoming, and it's called a remix of Enos Xenakis' Persepolis.
Hmm. Let's hear the piece, and we'll come back to you in time. Okay, here it is, Wedge by Fred Szymanski, our guest today on Calvos and Damien.
Thank you.
Wedge Remix. That by Fred Szymanski. We have a little noise in one of the microphones.
Oh, well.
Oh, that's better.
Yeah, that is.
Maybe it's right from the microphone itself. Okay. It could be one of those battery-operated jobbies where the battery's not making good connection.
Anyway, I should lick the
lick the ends of the battery.
All right.
You do that while we're off. Yeah.
Okay.
So, Fred, tell us about the piece and about the techniques you use to achieve it. These are techniques which are simply not part of the lay vocabulary. So
yes,
give us a rundown.
They're actually not part of the standard synthesis routines one would come, discover in electronic music studios. They're called non-standard synthesis, and it's derived. The reason it's called non-standard, or they're very experimental techniques. There's no model or instrument that the synthesis is using to in the analysis stage. The actual the work is done through a nonlinear function, and if I can simplify that, it's a nonlinear function that is actually iterated on itself, and one is sampling the phase space to derive the sounds that actually come out of the bifurcation of the phase space.
Let's back up even more at the beginning of that, and if you will explore very quickly how what sounds are the origin of it and what sort of approach you take to developing the piece before you get to the technique.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, we have the image from everything from the romantic Brahms at the piano through the person who's sampling and reconstructing through samples.
Right.
Where do you start? Where does your idea come from? And how do you choose one of these techniques to use?
It's essentially one is confronting usually two. In the tradition of the orchestra and the score. This comes out of like modeling and synthesis that emulates the tradition, the instrumental music, and that division of the two is pretty much inherent in the working processes in electronic music as well. Yeah, you're probably familiar with that. In sampling, one takes a sample and then one creates some kind of event or note or lattice work to place it in time. In contrast to that, I'm working with a technique that the technique that produces the sound actually produces the form. So the duality is overcome, and if you can say it that way, you're producing the iteration of or the feeding back of the sine wave on itself. Produces this type of erratic, fluctuating sound, and I try to capture that in the part of the aesthetic dimension is capturing that perturbation and using it as the form as well as the origin or the production of the sound.
Take us back to the baby blocks on this. The simplest possible function and how it would sound.
It's hard to describe, but it's pure synthesis. First of all, it's not a sample. It doesn't come from nature. It comes from the generation of the numbers itself.
Yep. Yep.
In DSP, in digital signal processing.
Yes.
It's a set up code that actually works in C sound, and I've written models. C sound is an extension of the Music 5 language that Max Matthews developed at Bell Labs. And I've taken Cecilia, which is a graphic interface that sits on top of C sound, and that was developed by Jean Piche at the University of Montreal.
Right.
And it allows me to draw the various functions or graphic breakpoint functions, little graphic diagrams that...
Do you draw them rather than create a formula for them, or do you?
The formula is set, but I'm accessing the formula with these breakpoint functions.
Okay.
So their breakpoint functions are graphic displays or line diagrams that progress through time. And once I have the model, the original instrument was not developed by me. It's developed by an Italian composer named Agostino Di Cipio. I've taken his instruments and then ramified them or expanded them into this other program, have the model, write the breakpoint functions, and then I ask it to resynthesize from scratch, and I produce this sound through these nonlinear functions, and it tends to be very noisy. It tends to be at times, and it's based on the fact that the iteration it feeds back on itself, and it has this tendency to create this kind of pointillistic sound that's very similar to granular synthesis.
Okay, let's get back to granular synthesis the next time through. Let's hear something.
Okay. I'll play an earlier laminar piece. I'll try to, sector 4.
Sector 4.
And this is granular synthesis using also some iterative, but it's not functional synthesis. It's actually using samples that are thus have iteration within, which is the type of feedback techniques, which I can talk about.
And where does this sit in your oeuvre?
This is the beginning, I would say, at least this type of material.
Okay. And in fact, the review that we read by Kieran was actually
about
this. So we have an emotional context of response and your descriptive context of creation. So let's see if we as listeners and our listeners, our audience, can synthesize that as they listen. Here it is from a CD called Laminar. This is the fourth cut, Sector 4.
Thank you.
Fred Szymanski, Sector 4.
Now, see, I found that just fascinating.
Yes.
I liked that a lot.
Really?
Yes, I did.
We promised ourselves a show full of unlistenable stuff, and then we got that very elegant sweet piece.
What are you doing? What are you pulling on us?
Yeah.
That's fine. I could hum to that.
Really?
Yeah,
that had definite melody to
right,
it.
Right, yes.
Well, I think I'm going to step back a moment, if you don't mind, and play some soundscape.
Sure.
Material.
Sure.
And it's hard to go from soundscape to where I am now. It's hard to imagine how I came from soundscape, but...
Let's have your definition of soundscape. See, these terms are really... A lot of these terms get very personal.
Right.
And so let's hear what you mean by soundscape.
Well, I try to, you know, because I'm presenting it and working with the students here at Goddard, I try to come up with a useful, at least credible definition of soundscape. So I try to take it from Murray Schafer, who said, you know, working with the environment, that can be the environment itself. It could be a collage or some kind of abstraction from the environment, but it entails interaction with the individual and the environment in some fashion.
Interaction in the process of composition or the process of presentation or both?
Both, yeah. And it would be the composition if you were working with a collage or a musical piece and deriving musical content from it and or presenting in musical context or just doing an analysis of the soundscape and the environment and working in, you know, area of noise pollution, let's say. There's an interesting article by Andrew McCartney, who was at Concordia University in Montreal.
Right, which is kind of a hotbed of electroacoustics.
Exactly. Yeah. And her article it's online. You can find it very easily. It's about soundscape composition as subversive to the electroacoustic norm. And her contention is that soundscape, which has been, you know, going on since the late 60s, early 70s, and in Canada and Vancouver at Simon Fraser University, it threatens the instrumental content of electroacoustic music, and it's been pushed to the side, and it's totally...
Why is that? Explain what that means.
She thinks there's a bias towards it, and it hasn't been covered in books, and it's subversive in the sense that people find it difficult to analyze. Pretty much as an analytical problem, because one is dealing with sounds in their purity and looking for the morphology of the timbre that's inherent in natural sounds, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, and composing and, you know, manipulating and transforming those properties, and so it eludes typical analytical techniques, where electroacoustic music might seem, you know, a radical thing in a sense, but it is very, very related and it's very similar to instrumental music in the history of Western art music.
It's very kind of an interesting thing because I wonder if there's almost a kind of a cultural, even a class a dichotomy between soundscape and electroacoustics.
Yes.
Because because soundscape has that personal character, indeed, with the audiences that listen to it. We had David Stevens on the show a couple of months ago, and he was making a point that he wasn't specifically talking about soundscape, but at least pieces that are in somewhat in that realm, as having more to do with the chill out room and the pop scene than they do with the university more abstract, as you would say, heritage of the instrumental music scene.
Right.
Yeah. So there might be that difference too,
mm-hmm,
almost a rivalry.
Yeah. Exactly. There's this tradition of it. It becomes. There's a purity in it's kind of a rigid aspect of the soundscape where it must have the property original sound. It doesn't deviate from that because they feel it would become electroacoustic. I don't really follow that. Trevor Wishart is a perfect example. Some of his work is contextual. You can really hear the environment he works in. But It's quite easy to go beyond that because the transformations he works with are software-based and based on CDP, Composer's Desktop Project, and he has written extensively about that, and he was at Arkheim also, and a lot of the original techniques in the phase vocoder and time scale transformations and mutation all are derived from Trevor Wishart's work.
Let's hear.
Okay.
What do we have here?
We have 3, 4, and possibly 7. 7 is the title piece. It's called Entendez. It's it was recorded in Paris in 1992. And I hope to have conveyed the feeling of being in space with people in the language of French.
Excellent. Our guest is Fred Szymanski. This is cuts 3, 4, and 7 from Entendez. And gosh, we'll be back probably in about 15 minutes. This should be wonderful. Here it is.
Eine spezielle Einstellung gibt es schon in Caesar, weil die vor der Pause noch einhält. Für sich selber kontrollieren Polizisten vor der Stadt ein- und ausfahrende Autos. Sie suchen nach Waffen. Wenige Kilometer südlich von Caesar wurden am frühen Morgen zwei Dörfer mit Mörsergranaten beschossen. Sicher ist die Region dann ja nicht.
four sections from Fred Szymanski's Attendez. Listen to 4, 5, 7, and the concluding section, section 11.
Those are wonderful. What's
soundscape.
Yes, they are. And what is the genesis for, say, one section of those? How do you start?
Think about it or approach it? There was some background. I had been listening to soundscape work, and specifically composers like Barry Truax and Hildegard Westerkamp. They usually use, Hildegard's usually uses gesture, and she integrates the space. She works in the ecological, electroacoustic or acoustic domain, and just does not transform the sound at all. I actually transformed the sound quite a lot, as you could tell, but all the sounds originally came from Paris, but I was thinking about changing the context rather, more like a cinematic change, where in a montage type of consciousness, where one can go very quickly to another space. So the sonic space, rather than conforming it to a bird or a specific animal and placing it, I actually haven't replaced anything. Everything is exactly as it was recorded, but I quickly go between different spaces and social spaces. And I was interested in language spaces where people were gathering and walking and moving, and then you feel like you're drawn through those spaces. And then there were some other electroacoustic techniques thrown in there.
That's exactly right. I was drawn through. I was on a little travelogue. I felt like, oh, this is Walt Disney. I'm being drawn. Well, it was better. Sorry, it's better than Disneyland. It was better than being there.
Right.
Just lovely. And you're not using a Wallensack.
It's more
something
like the Wisconsin Dells.
Yes, exactly. That's not a Wallensack you're packing either, is it?
No.
No, I didn't think so.
Well, you have something mundane to say now.
Oh, yes, I do. It's that time. Hi, I'm Fred Szymanski, and you're listening to Calvis and Damien's New Music Bazaar. You're Red Alert for new music and cinema for the years.
Yes! Ooh. Cinema for the years. All right. Thank you very much. That's good. On WGDR, Plainfield.
The important part?
Yeah,
not necessarily.
We have to please the federal communications folks.
Oh, them.
There is so clear a distinction between soundscape and your your material that's not generated out of existing sounds. You would think that coming from the same composer, the relationships would be clearer than the distinctions. Is the nature of how you make it so strong that you can't make it integrated, or you just simply don't choose to?
I think it is related, but I don't know if I can articulate it. What I was talking about, going through spaces physically in the soundscape, I actually move, and that's a macroscopic notion of phenomena, a social space. In the synthesis work, I'm actually working in a microscopic area of or in granular synthesis. But I'm actually moving through the space, and like the visual work I do, I'm very interested in how motion is causal in the production of form.
So if we were to listen to Fred Szymanski over the course of a few days and just absorb your work, we would hear those relationships.
You might conceive of them. If you know what I mean. I mean, they're not really related timbrely, or they're related instrumentally or traditionally in an analytical way, but they're related conceptually because I'm interested in motion and the way I was intrigued by. I think my soundscape work was a launching pad for me to go into synthesis and to think about the microscopic and the macroscopic form, coming together and producing form in the synthesis routines, in a way of coming to terms with that as well.
Because there's a known kind of familiar sound for a listener to hang on to, it would seem that the soundscape has a sort of a high accessibility level. And I know this is the ultimately dreaded question every time it's asked, but we repeat it. How do we listen to the generated work?
The
coming to it from the outside.
Right. How do you approach it?
Yeah, as a listener who's, you know, largely involved in listening to pop over the course of a lifetime or background music, how does one approach it? Yeah.
It's hard for me to answer, of course, but I look at it as a pure form and as material in and of itself. That's the way I intended it to be, in the production of it. And I do have some concern for the listener. I'm interested. I do arrange it in some way and try to make it, constrain it within perceptual limits for the listener. I would have to say, it can be challenging at times. But there's two ways to listen to it. It's sort of like Frank Zappa or maybe Eno would say this. If you listen to it very low, it's ambient. If you listen to it very in a high dB in a large way, it's noise music or it's about noise.
I found it interesting that there are inaudible sounds in some of your work. I downloaded the samples from your website, the three short samples. I didn't bring them along, but I listened to them, and I was wondering if there was something that I was sensing but I couldn't hear. And so I threw the waveforms up onto my sound editor,
yeah.
And I noticed that there were subsonic frequencies, pretty close to DC in there.
Right.
Why is that? How do you account for the presence of these subsonics? Are they deliberate? Are they sort of a hidden message of some kind?
Thank you for doing that, though. For putting them up on your scope and doing a sonogram. But it's a byproduct of the technique of the iterative functional synthesis. But the last piece in Laminar, it sounds noisy. It's a loop, and I do the transformations, and the iteration magnifies the frequencies in high and low, and it spins out of control, so to speak.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And it's dangerous. I'm very interested in the nonlinear behavior of speakers. I'm sort of pushing that limit.
Okay.
And what can be reproduced and what can be heard.
So you're expensive, are you? You want equipment?
Yeah. I have blown out headphones and speakers while listening to them.
Let's hear another.
Okay. This is an upcoming CD that will be released on JADK Productions. And it comes out of Amsterdam in 2002.
And what's the name of it, and which one are we going to hear from this?
Let's hear 1, 3, 5, et cetera, et cetera. It's called Manifold.
Oh, we have something in common with James Bond.
I saw that.
His variations are called Manifold.
I noticed that.
Yeah. All right. Here it is, Manifold Feed from Fred Szymanski. We'll be back in a little bit.
Thank you.
Had to jump in there on that one. Four sections from Manifold Feed by our guest today, Fred Szymanski.
And we were playing it low-volume ambient as opposed to high-volume noise.
Right. Threefold one.
I hope.
And what do we have there? Oh, phase F, feed four, and oh, feed two, the four sections of that piece.
So he's working on his titles there.
Yeah, the titles are improving. And we all, of course, on Calvus and Damien, the title is the piece.
It's everything, you know.
Yeah, it's everything. So
I'll try to remember that.
Okay.
Well, thanks so much for joining us. You know, the time has just gone by. We only have 5 minutes left, and we have a couple quick pieces to play. You're going to tell us a little bit more about the next composer.
It's a good friend and mentor, Agostino DiCipio from Italy. This is some new work. It's called Emerging Rhythms. It's granular synthesis, and I hope you like it.
And the titles?
Study number one,
study
number five.
Right.
Here they are. Fred Szymanski, thanks so much.
Thank you.
We'll have you on again, promise. We want to do that.
I really enjoyed it.
Here it is.
A production of Multimedia.